Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Our guest on Edgewise today is Scott Keller. He's director in the Southern California office of McKinsey & Company, and he leads its transformational change practice in the Americas. He's co-author with Colin Price of the book Beyond Performance. Scott, welcome to Edgewise.
Thank you for having me. Joy to be here.
Scott, you did a lot of research for the book. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. This is probably the largest research effort in the field of organizational effectiveness that's ever been done. When you look at some of the seminal books in the area of organizational effectiveness and change management, In Search of Excellence was published in 1982. Built to Last was published in 1994. Those books are full of wisdom, good insight, but In Search of Excellence was basically a look at 48 U.S. companies. Built to Last was about 18 companies. And when you step back from those analyses, if you ask the question, where are those companies today? And in particular, just before the financial crisis in 2006, because obviously that was a unique time in history, what you'd find is 33% remained high performers, 20% no longer existed, and then 46% would be considered struggling from a performance standpoint. As we looked at those kind of data sets, we said, what can we do in the new century to have a bigger, broader look at this question? And how do we ensure our answers aren't based on companies that are going to potentially fail at the same rates other companies would fail, excellent or not? So we've looked at over 500 companies across the world. We've done over 500,000 surveys of individual executives to understand their thinking and how they manage and lead. We've also put into practice in the field, in our consulting work, the tools and techniques in over 100 companies to refine them and test them, again, around the world, different sectors, different industries.
In the book, you emphasize that beyond performance requires organizational health for long-term success.
Yeah, beyond performance is organizational health. Our organizations today are wired for mediocrity. They don't excel at rates that one might expect, given we've worked together as human beings for millennia trying to get things done. But look at the statistics. For example, John Cotter wrote an article about why change programs fail in 1995, and he found that 30% of change programs succeed in large organizations. He did the same study in the year 2000, and then in 2005, and he found that, yet again, 30% succeed. And in 2010, the same statistic was true. So the field of change management hasn't changed anything in that regard. So most organizations aren't succeeding at getting to the aspirations they're setting. The reason for that is managers are much more biased towards managing the performance side of the change equation than what we call the health side.
What's the difference?
The performance side is the traditional strategic and operational and financial aspects of running a business. What is your return on capital? What is your total return to shareholders? What does your revenue growth look like? It might be stock turns, it might be other operational measures. Organizational health, on the other hand, is how well you as a company align your organization on the goal you're trying to achieve, then execute against that without any friction in the system. And then how do you renew yourself along the way, keep the organizational energy up, and then strive towards that continuous improvement. Organizational health is as important as organizational performance. Performance and health, managed with equal emphasis and rigor, are the answer to building an organization that will be here for not only the near term, but for the long term.
Does organizational health have something to do with jobs as well?
Organizational health is linked very directly to an organization's performance. We can measure health, we can measure performance, we can understand the correlations, and we can also understand the causality. Healthy organizations do better than organizations who are unhealthy. They last longer. They're higher performing. So as we think about jobs and organizations who are growing and thriving, even in a difficult economic environment, those are going to be the healthier organizations. The second thing is healthy organizations attract better talent than other organizations because healthy organizations are able to harness the full potential of human beings as they enter into the workplace.
And how can I, as an executive, determine if my company is healthy or not?
There is a way to measure those three aspects of health: alignment, execution, and renewal. And this is something that's become much more of a science than an art. They do break down into some very clear elements, like to what extent do you have accountability in your organization? How do you coordinate and control risk management? What kind of capabilities do you have in your organization? What kind of motivation do you have in your organization? How externally oriented are you?
Very interesting. Could you go deeper on that for us?
There are 9 elements of organizational health, which you can very clearly define and measure quite reliably in an organization. And we can even break those down further into 37 management practices, things leaders actually do, practices you can observe, whether they're happening or not, that relate to each of these elements. For example, there are practices that help achieve accountability, like role clarity and performance contracts for people. There are things like, what does your consequence management system look like? And how do you get a sense of personal responsibility and ownership? So leaders can, with the help of what we call the Organizational Health Index, do the diagnostic on how healthy are we today and have quantitative data that can be measured and managed over time.
Scott, in your book, you've also mentioned it's a major mistake to copy management best practices from other companies. Why is that?
I'll answer that by way of an analogy.
Sure, go ahead.
We were working late in the office and we wanted to get dinner brought in. The team knew that the main person whose office we were in loved pizza and he loved seafood. When they looked at the menu of the local Italian eatery, they had seafood pizza on the menu, and they ordered that. When our colleague bit into this pizza, he said, "This is the worst thing I've ever tasted."
And what exactly does that suggest?
The whole idea there is that good ingredients combined in certain ways will create something magic. Peanut butter and jelly together are way better than each individually. They can also create not so good combinations. That analogy, as it relates to management reality, is those 37 management practices that I mentioned sit beneath what drives organizational health. Those aren't just individual best practices that exist in isolation. They work together in a system, and they interrelate to one another. Different choices you make in terms of how you manage your organization can reinforce or take away.
Can you give us an example of that?
Yep. If a company wants to motivate its employees, it has a number of practices it could use. There's meaningful values, inspirational leaders, creating career opportunities for people to work towards and look forward to, and rewards and incentives. Rewards and incentives is the least effective. Above a certain level anyway, rewards and incentives isn't a big driver of motivation. Most leaders and managers get that, and we reaffirmed that in our research. But we had the benefit of not just looking at individual management practices and saying, which of these can give you more motivation in isolation. We could look at them in the context of all 37 management practices and find out if certain combinations created either the peanut butter and jelly effect, 1+1=3, or the seafood pizza effect, where you actually diminish the impact. And just using that motivation example, if you use rewards and incentives in a internally competitive environment, it's a really effective motivator. In fact, you have a 95% probability of getting a motivated workforce versus in a very collaborative environment, a 48% chance. We could do this across all of the management practices in our database and ask, are there any combinations that managers should put together to create healthy organizations, which in turn drive high performance over time? And we found there were 4 archetypes of healthy organizations. There's a knowledge-focused archetype, a market-focused archetype, an execution-focused archetype, and a leadership-driven archetype. This is why, if you try to take individual isolated best practices from another company and bring them into your system, you don't know for sure whether you're going to get the seafood pizza effect or whether you're going to get the peanut butter and jelly effect. And we now have all of the science and data to tell you what's the case.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your 5-stage process for achieving organizational excellence, which you call the 5 A's.
Yeah, so the first is aspire, which is where do you want to go? That's the first question leaders need to be able to answer. Leaders who answer it both for the performance side of the equation and the health side of the equation with equal emphasis, equal rigor, with equal ability to measure and manage are the leaders who are setting themselves up for a successful transformation program and building the health they'll need to endure and thrive in the long run. So what specifically are those measures? On the performance side of things, what are the financial targets you're going after? That might be revenue, it might be efficiency. There's a number of targets. Different industries have different measures that matter. But on the health side, it's a whole different question. So when we ask executives, do you know what your financial targets are? By and large, most would say, yes, we're trying to double the revenue or double the size of whatever it might be in 5 years. And they're pretty clear on how that'll work. When we then ask them, do you know what your health target is to ensure your organization can deliver against that? You often get blank stares, first of all. And then once you explain what health is, you have people saying, well, we do an employee engagement survey. Maybe we could measure talent retention. But very few leaders have a more holistic view of how healthy do we need to be? How do we measure it? How do we manage it? This is where those four archetypes I mentioned come into play. You may aspire to building an organization that is heavy in terms of its ability to leverage knowledge. An organization like that will focus on, how do I get great talent? How do I put them in the right roles? How do I ensure they have the right incentives? How do I get them to have personal ownership and empowerment? Now, that's very different than, say, a Procter & Gamble or a company who wants to be market-focused. That's a different archetype than a knowledge focus. Those people should focus a lot more on, how do I get the right business partnerships in place? How do I get the right competitive insights? How do I get the right government and community relations happening? They also, importantly, need to focus on financial management. A lot of customer-focused companies can end up doing a lot of things for the customer that actually don't make money. So for each archetype, it's very clear what those management practices are that will help companies achieve a healthy version of those archetypes. And leaders can set targets and aspirations for their organizational health using these archetypes as a guide and be very targeted at what they're trying to improve.
Okay, now the next one is assess.
The assess part of the equation is a very important question that is often overlooked. Once people know where they want to go, what they miss is that second step, which asks the question, what is our change readiness? How ready are we to go on this journey? Do we have the skill in the organization required? And do we have the mindset we need to enable those skills to come to life?
Now, why is mindset important in the success or failure of an organizational change effort?
I'm going to steal a story from Gary Hamel because it's a very instructive one.
Okay.
Experimenters put four monkeys in a cage, and they have a platform with a ladder going up to it, and bananas on the platform. The monkeys go up the ladder because they want to get the bananas, but there's a big glass of water, which is going to knock them off the ladder, so the monkeys can't get up to the bananas. Over time, they decide, well, let's just leave them there. Now, what happens then is they take one monkey out, and they put a new monkey in the cage who's never seen the blast of water. At the same time, they take the blast of water out of the room. This new monkey sees bananas, starts to go up. He's bananas, let's go for it. The other monkeys pull him off the ladder. We don't do that around here. The new monkey would do that a couple times and then just decide, it's not worth getting pulled down by all my new buddies who I need to get along with. So he stopped going for the bananas. Over the period of a week, the researchers take out one of the old monkeys and put in new monkeys, one at a time, and the same thing happens. And at the end of the week, you've got four monkeys sitting in the cage, and they're not going up the ladder. There hasn't been anything stopping them other than their own mindset of, we don't do that around here. And they've learned it from one another.
So what should managers do?
Take, for example, a sales stimulation program. You need to increase sales in your front line, and you might have mindsets and certain capabilities in your salespeople today that you think are pretty good. It may be that you decide we need to give people better scripts. We need to train them more on product knowledge. What most people find when they do that is they don't get nearly the lift in performance they want because the mindsets haven't shifted from good sales mindsets to great sales mindsets. Let me give you an example. A good sales mindset might be give the customer what they want. Another might be treat the customer as you would like to be treated. Those sound like very reasonable sales mindsets, but a great sales mindset is different than that. A great sales mindset says, I'm here to help the customer articulate unarticulated needs. And if salespeople have that mindset, they will do all of the things that you would want them to do in their little script naturally because they'll be asking the probing questions. They'll be looking for, how else can I help this customer?
Okay, so that was assess. And after that is the architect stage.
Yeah, it's getting the plan together. What are the practical steps that will take us from where we are to our destination? It's your very clear game plan on how to do those things you need to do.
And what happens after the architect stage?
The fourth step is act. Take the action you've planned on in your architect stage. How do you manage that journey? How do you keep the energy up in the organization? How do you make sure you're on track? And no journey goes according to plan, especially a large-scale transformation. How are you going to adapt and adjust along the way? And then the fifth step is advance. The nature equivalent is we're a caterpillar, and now we want to be a butterfly. It's a big change, big shift. Organizations can't live in that continuous transformation mode all the time. So at some point you have to transition into, now we're the butterfly. How do we just continuously improve as a butterfly, as a new organization? A big change program is typically heavy in terms of initiatives, has a certain cadence of how things are monitored and reviewed. Transitioning from that into the steady state, this is just how we operate, and we continuously improve relentlessly at a pace faster than the competition, is advance.
I would think that this is the key to achieving the effective transition.
That's absolutely right. True transformation is something that can't go back. The butterfly can't go back to being a caterpillar, but a lot of organizations get to be bigger, fuzzier caterpillars, and then they'll go back to where they were before. So this is key to maintaining, sustaining, and improving upon the transformation you've had as that step five.
Exactly. Now, before we wrap up, do you have any other key points you want to leave our audience with?
Absolutely. The one thing we haven't covered that is a key part of the thinking, particularly as you look at the health side of the equation, which more relates to the people side of things, is there are places where we act more irrationally than one might imagine we would. And the same way the field of economics has been transformed with the advent of behavioral economics, the field of management and change management and organizational effectiveness is in need of a similar transformation in how it thinks about the world, because there are a number of ways people act in a predictable yet seemingly irrational way. And leaders who are smart and well-intentioned but don't understand that will do things that will frustrate themselves and frustrate their employees.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Do you have any examples?
Yes. Social scientists do these experiments. So they'll put a big group of people in the room. They'll divide them into two groups. One group, they'll give lottery tickets with numbers. The other group, they'll give blank pieces of paper. Those people, they'll ask to write their own number. And then they'll go up on stage about to pull the winning number and say, we're going to go back on the floor and our researchers are going to try to buy back that lottery ticket from you. And what they're looking for is, how much more, if anything, do you have to pay the people who wrote their own number versus the people who are handed a lottery ticket number? They've done this in every geography, every demographic, and they've never found that you have to pay anything less than five times more to the people who wrote their own number. That is completely irrational. There's no reason to think if you wrote your own number, you have more of a probability of winning. But it's completely predictable. It happens every time. The lesson for managers is, to the extent you can have employees feel like they're writing their own lottery ticket towards the change that you want to see happen, it's very likely they'll have five times more the commitment to executing against that than otherwise.
Now, do you have any concluding thoughts for our listeners today?
Most organizations are truly wired for mediocrity. That is a massive problem. And for the first time, I think we have a proven approach that solves that problem.
We've been speaking to Scott Keller. He's co-author with Colin Price of the book Beyond Performance. Scott, thanks for being with us on Edgewise today.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
AMA training courses are now available direct to your desktop. Our virtual seminars deliver the power of AMA training without the travel, without time away from the office, but with the ability to catapult your skill set and career to new heights. For more information, visit amanet.org/virtual-seminars. We'd love to get your feedback on today's program. You can either email us at podcast@amanet.org or call 800-697-3406. Your comments may become part of a future program. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.